Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Back in Studio A with my guest this morning, as I mentioned, archaeologist Paul Reed is joining me once again. Of course, he works with Archaeology Southwest. He's done work at Aztec ruins and Salmon ruins here in our area and many, many more. Paul, welcome back to KSJE. Nice to see you. Nope, I think you're still muted, Paul. We're not hearing you, but we are seeing you.
There we go.
There he is.
A bad idea a radio show to be muted, but pretty glad to be back.
That's all right. Now we can hear you and see you, so thank you very much for joining us. Also, our other guest this morning, Dr. Sarah Owis, is joining us this morning. And Dr. Owis, good morning to you. You are the Cyber Southwest Data Specialist with Archaeology Southwest. That's quite a title.
Yes, it is. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate you being here to talk a little bit about your research that I find fascinating because it involves food, and that's one of my favorite topics. And so let me ask you a little bit about your work, and we'll ask Paul to chime in here as well. But you are have been studying foodways of the ancestral Puebloans, and that's another term that maybe we're not all familiar with, but it's a little bit more encompassing, I think, than maybe just studying diet and substance and things along that line. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, if you're thinking about diet, you're thinking about calories, you're thinking about macronutrients, micronutrients, and all of that is, of course, very important. When I talk about foodways, when I try to approach that research, I'm thinking about how do you produce the food? How are folks preparing it? How are people consuming it? What are those dynamics around a meal? So it includes kind of all those parts about how you grow a crop and kind of what it does for your body, but it gets that really kind of thick cultural field that we so much enjoy when we eat.
Right. Understood. And of course, you're looking at this from a perspective of the populations that lived in this area and others, right? The ancestral Puebloans and how they went about growing and producing enough food for their populations?
Yeah.
Got it. And so, Paul, chime in a little bit with me too, because we've always heard that maybe, you know, food was an important part of life, obviously, and there was a lot of challenges with growing food in this part of the world. And so what do we know about how food was produced, like in places like Aztec or Salmon or Chaco Canyon, for example?
Well, you know, and this is certainly a good chunk of what Sarah has worked on, you know, over these years, but we know that for ancestral Pueblo people, you know, they depended on this triumvirate of three crops, corn, beans, and squash, and multiple squash varieties. And that this, you know, that the cultivation of these food products goes back thousands of years, and that this really formed the basis for how Pueblo people have been able to make their living, you know, through all these many millennia. And yeah, and what we see then is with those sort of that base of these three crops, and along with a whole lot of other natural plant foods, they then added with, you know, with hunted products, with big game, and then in certain time periods, especially in the 1200s in the ancestral Pueblo area, they started cultivating turkeys in a large scale. So yeah, it really is fascinating to see how different foods have been sort of part of this expanded diet and food way over, you know, these many hundreds of years.
Right, right. And by this time in history, Paul or Sarah, whoever wants to answer this question, I would guess that these folks had come pretty accomplished at growing these at least three main crops and foods that we're talking about. They had pretty good success with their growing techniques. Dr. Owis, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, some of the earliest evidence for corn is found surprisingly far north in New Mexico. So there's, you know, thousands of years of history, especially with growing maize. And, you know, the Southwest is a challenging place to grow crops. And so you have real up years, you have real down years, but the folks doing the farming, they were masters at using every little facet of the landscape to raise these crops and forage and kind of protect themselves from climate fluctuation.
Right. And does your work involve too some of the irrigation evidence that has been discovered and things along that line? Because as you mentioned, it's a challenging place to grow food or almost anything, right, without water and being able to control water in some cases.
Yeah, I had the great pleasure to do a lot of work in the Zuni area, ancestral Zuni. We call it like the Cibola region, mostly in New Mexico and a little bit into eastern Arizona. And there's a lot of early evidence for irrigation, not maybe to the scale you see with folks in the southern Arizona, but people choosing to live by springs, and especially kind of as the large villages around modern Zuni form, they're 100% irrigating.
Got you. And when we talk about places like Chaco Canyon with the seemingly large populations or folks that are traveling there for whatever reason, they were needing to grow and have, I guess, enough food for these larger populations and storage of food for these larger populations. That's part of your work as well, is it not, to study all that?
Yeah, I think if you study just the production end and you don't kind of track, what scale are folks cooking, where is the stuff being stored, you can miss out some of those dynamics, which I think Paul can chime in on this, is maybe much more interesting and complex in sort of the Chaco core.
Right. Paul Reed, we know about some of the trading routes and things like that too that you and I have talked about, right? That probably enters into a little bit of this, does it not?
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously there's a lot of debate about Chaco and how a society functioned, but I think most folks are in agreement that Chaco was an amazing economic and social and religious center that had a whole lot of people coming in and out, food being traded, other things being traded. Some of the more interesting recent studies have really shown that there is a lot of arable land in Chaco, and this kind of contrasts with other studies that have suggested that it was going to be really difficult or was difficult for people to raise sufficient food there. But one of the things that I've kind of worked through and these a couple of decades of a career is that Pueblo people live where they can grow corn. And if they can't grow corn, they're not likely to establish a large population. So with Chaco, we really see that development of really serious maize agriculture in the late 500s and 600s, and then running all the way through the 1200s. As we look at the area right around Farmington, Salmon, and Aztec, when those sites were built with folks coming up from Chaco, I think one of the huge attractions was, of course, the ability to plant many, many fields of corn, beans, and squash, and other plant materials in that area because of the vast water supplies. So one of the ideas that I've had, and other colleagues have certainly elaborated, is the folks in Chaco developing very sophisticated systems for water movement and management, and then coming up to the Middle San Juan, Salmon, Aztec areas in the La Plata Valley, and they're able to apply that technology. And some folks must have thought, wow, now we've got a whole lot of water. So I think there was a lot of corn being grown in the valleys around Farmington, definitely.
Right. Thank you, Paul. And Dr. Owis, do they, I mean, your research shows that the populations that you study were mostly eating these three main components. Did they ever, or do we know if they ever kind of reached out and thought of adding other things? Paul mentioned turkeys, wild turkeys, things like that, or fish, or any evidence of any of these other things entering their diets?
Yeah, well, at least I can speak to this strongest for the Zuni area.
Okay.
They have kind of an amazing suite of supplements. You have to think about maybe you're getting 80% of your calories from corn. Like, what do you do to dress that up around the year, especially when fresh corn is off the table and you're eating dried corn? So all kinds of small seeded plants, all kinds of nuts got added. Sunflower seeds, like add some oil, add some crunch. Like, how do you flavor your maize foods? So there's a real large group of wild plants that were gathered for thousands of years right alongside corn. Turkeys are a big part of the Zuni story from about 1200 to 1400 as well. So they're absolutely raising them, probably in their villages.
Got you. And I'm seeing in some of the information about your work a reference to watermelon. Is that also part of what you've been looking at? Is that more later, comes later with native populations?
Yeah, so watermelon is a more recent sort of undertaking I'm doing with a couple folks at the University of Michigan. Watermelon is a really fascinating story that kind of comes with early Spanish contact, but it's an example of a food that was very much chosen by Native American communities, and spreads within a couple generations, basically across North America. So sort of tribe to tribe contact and exchange. People just love watermelon. It's got this really sort of special, joyful social connotation. And in southern Arizona, it's one that when Padre Kino arrives, he's like, how do these folks have watermelon already? It's a really, really fascinating kind of exchange story.
Interesting. And it keeps showing up apparently, right? In different cultures, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Lots of introduction routes probably into North America for watermelon, certainly the Spanish kind of coming up through Mexico, and then it just spreads so quickly.
Right.
So people love growing it, and it's similar to squash in some ways, but it's this wonderfully water rich and sweet food, which there's not a lot of sweet foods easily available. Think about how much work it takes to process cactus fruit. It was a wonderful addition for a lot of folks.
Right, very true, very true. And does grow here fairly well. So that's
Yeah, and
amazing.
we can see from research on sort of seed keeping and sort of records on what become heirloom varieties for a lot of different native groups out here. People are locally adapting it pretty fast, and storage capabilities, sweetness. There's a lot of history for watermelon varieties out here.
Interesting. And when we think about the taste, I guess, of these foods and things along that, like corn and beans and some of the things that really go way back for the ancestral Puebloans, you're right, there's not a lot of sweet foods that we hear about. I think there's been talk about chocolate, right? Paul Reed and trade and things along that line. But does that type of thing, Dr. Oz, come into your research as well as some of these other maybe foods or specialty items maybe that would be just reserved for either the wealthy or special occasions perhaps to enjoy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so in the kind of umbrella of food ways, which you can take a lot of directions, I've kind of really focused on cuisine. And then, trying to do an archaeology of cuisine is challenging. And so one of the things that you can sort of tease out is some things around flavor. And if you talk to real living humans, flavor is one of those central parts about our food. It's, we have all these memories associated with flavor. And we really seek out certain flavors that become a core part of like our food culture. So trying to think about the archaeological record in terms of flavor kind of adds a lot to sort of the story of how foods change through time or don't change. And yeah, sweetness, fat, like all the things we know about good cooking, like how did folks achieve those things? The chocolate they're getting is not sweet like ours.
Right.
Their palates would have been so different.
Very true. But certainly not the same as eating corn 12 months out of the year either, right? I mean, that would, and as you mentioned, adding nuts, adding other things to kind of liven up or maybe just change things up from time to time would make sense if you're eating the same thing all the time, or fresh corn during the season and dried corn out of season.
Yep.
Gotcha. Interesting. Paul Reed, again, we have evidence of all of these things here too, don't we? At Chaco and Salmon and Aztec and other places in our local area, right? Of these foods and cuisine that Dr. Owis is talking about.
Right. Really just an amazing array. And we do tend to focus a lot on the big three, the corn, beans, and the squash varieties. But and Sarah certainly worked with this, but there are so many other natural plants that came in, goosefoot, amaranth, all the little plants that produce seeds, Indian rice grass, bug seed. So there's this broad variety of plants that came in and had food use. And then, of course, talking about the medicinal uses, not really what we're on today, but
Sure.
another just broad range of really of a research topic. And the way that I've come to think about sort of the food ways and the way people use plants is that, these folks in the past really had broad knowledge of all the plants in their environment, where they grew, the season they grew, and all the broad range of uses. And they weren't necessarily the same from group to group either. So we do find sort of a broad range of how this particular group might have used a plant to treat some particular medical ailment. This group used another one, and sometimes plants do double duty as well. So, I think really from a standpoint of looking into the past and trying to understand past behavior, plant use is just this endlessly fascinating topic.
Very good. Thank you, Paul. And Dr. Owens, do we know, or do you know from your research, kind of how cuisine evolved over the like habitation occupancy of places like Chaco Canyon or Aztec ruins and things like that? And from what's left, how are you able to determine, I guess, maybe what folks were eating during what period of occupation? How precise can you be?
Well, it's a long kind of process to get maybe higher resolution, but kind of generally as groups in the sort of northern southwest are getting into larger village formations, we know some things about kind of additional diversity added. I think we can see there are new kind of varieties of maize are continuously kind of making their way across the Americas. Some of the flowery varieties of maize come in. We get more diversity in beans that they're cultivating. They never drop anything, but mm-hmm. you know, folks are trading and communicating across Arizona, say, and introducing new varieties. And then, you know, if we look at groundstone, if we look at, you know, some of the more maybe neglected museum collections, we can see like baking slabs. So one of the things that really is interesting to me is the kind of flatbreads, the paper thin maize flatbreads that are maybe most famous kind of today at Hopi. Like those are absolutely a technology, a new kind of cuisine that come in, you know, 1275 and are kind of working and spreading. And those are incredibly complex to make. So there's, you know, some real interesting changes and maybe kind of highly visible and important foods that are maize focused, but have these, you know, incredible kind of production qualities and, you know, visually are very striking.
Right. It sounds like maybe recipes are getting more sophisticated.
Yeah.
And Paul mentioned plants and things like that too. And so I'm sure your research includes looking at some of the way plants were used with these other foodstuffs in the food ways that you're looking at.
Absolutely. I mean, my training, at my core, I started as a paleoethnobotanist. So, you know, plants and people in the past are kind of what got me into archaeology. So I get a real joy from looking at what plants are folks collecting. And then especially when we have cases where there's maybe multiple language and culture groups together, you know, there are differences in sort of the flavors people are interested in. There are, you know, in the upper Little Colorado area, you know, some folks in these settlements were choosing to hike out to the White Mountains to get, you know, walnuts. Others weren't interested in that. You know, people, you know, before refrigeration spend an awful lot of time getting the foods they want, and sometimes much more work is put into it than I would ever expect. So plants can kind of give you hints about that.
Right. And storage too, right? I mean, that was another ongoing battle, I would think, right? To store during the non-growing season.
Most of your life was spent, you know, trying to prepare and process food. It's wild.
Right. It's so much different than what we're used to today, I'm sure. But it was important because that was whether you survived winter maybe or didn't.
Absolutely. And, you know, the kind of rich traditions of seed keeping, you know, there's a lot of ancestral Pueblo and legacy there. Often kind of men and women have these very complementary roles in planting and seed keeping and sort of keeping the next generation of crops going.
Right. And Paul Reed, when we talk about places like Chaco Canyon, Salmon, and Aztec, right? I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, weren't there entire rooms or blocks of rooms maybe dedicated to storage of food and things like that?
Right, definitely. And, you know, the stuff before, the grinding rooms are one of the more interesting things. You know, there's room 90 at Pueblo Bonito, room 91 at Salmon, rooms at Aztec and both sides, east and west, where there were literally 10 or 15 matates lined up where, you know, groups of perhaps women were grinding corn for a long time to produce the meal that would then go into the flatbreads or tortillas, you know, whatever form they took. And one of the ideas about Salmon that's really interesting with this, you know, enhanced agricultural production being next to, you know, a great water source, is that folks at Salmon were probably processing a lot of corn and then using that as a contribution into the Chacoan trade system to trade, you know, sacks of cornmeal down into Chaco and to sort of keep those relations going. So yeah, the folks in this interval were very interested in processing a whole lot of corn. Sarah mentioned the flowery varieties. Those are particularly, you know, useful for grinding into pretty fine cornmeal, which then becomes a food source you can store for a very long time. And again, you can trade it. So So that is huge. And then, of course, the other side, as you mentioned, is the storage facilities. So with all the large Chaco sites, large Pueblo sites, it's probably not a overestimation to say up to half the rooms at any point are serving primary storage functions for food or for other items. So yeah, a really big and important part of it.
Right. Very interesting. So, Dr. Owis, I guess could some of these foods that were being created and prepared be valuable, have a value, I guess, for trade and things like that in this ancient culture?
Absolutely. I mean, ancient and still today, I mean, cornmeal is, corn is life. It's hard to overstate how important corn is in terms of ceremonials and prayer. Like finely ground cornmeal, especially of kind of white corn varieties, is very important, not in just a kind of consumed physical way. So I think, contributions of cornmeal were absolutely essential part of the economy in ways that we might not immediately register.
Right. But certainly had a value, which explains maybe why so much time, effort, and resources were put towards preparing it and growing it and storing it, correct? In all those areas. Dr. Oz, we're almost out of time this morning, but can you share with us maybe what's next in your research? Is there some other place that you'd like to look into or some other area of food ways that still has some question marks for you?
Well, I'm very much interested in sort of the spaces between all the work that has been done, hundreds of years, archaeology, ethnography, and what's in museum collections, and yeah, what are those untold food stories? So I'm excited to be getting ready to do some work on sort of women's spaces and materials from somewhat that food angle. Maybe paying a lot of attention to what groundstone can tell us when we also look at the plants and the architecture, and so kind of doing that kind of angle, really focusing on something that has been sort of neglected in archaeological history.
Interesting. And you mentioned maybe looking at some of some collections, some museum collections, and maybe discovering new evidence or new information, and maybe some technology can help you to do that. Is that also part of what the future holds, not maybe just for
Oh,
you, but others doing
absolutely.
this kind of work?
Yeah, the catalogs and museums are, they're often understaffed, and depending on when they got collections, they may never have been cataloged thoroughly. Especially plant and groundstone stuff is often unfamiliar unless you have a specialist. So, in my experience, I've found griddles used for, making tortillas or other things that went unrecognized. Certainly, even with corn, beautiful collections of all kinds of items made with corn materials that just it's labeled as corn. So there's a real wealth of material that is incredibly rich in terms of its storytelling and connection to descendant communities. So doing a lot of museum visits is incredibly rewarding for this stuff.
Nice. Well, we look forward to maybe getting an update from you as your research continues. And thank you for sharing what you've already accomplished with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you very much, Paul Reed. Again, exciting research and a kind of a new insight, I think, into the populations that call this area and the rest of the Southwest home over all these thousands of years that we talk about, but a really important part of the culture, what they ate, how they ate it, things like that.
Right, and as Sarah noted, something that folks have really barely scratched the surface on. So, one of the more exciting things from my perspective is the work with the museum collections really feeds into this notion of preservation archaeology, where we're not going out and digging a whole lot of new sites or maybe any sites, but we're taking advantage of what's already in collections. We're working closely with indigenous folks, and we're really trying to sort out some of the more interesting questions. So, yeah, definitely exciting research.
Very cool. Well, Paul, thank you for bringing Dr. Owis to us this morning and, of course, yourself. And it's always a great conversation. And so thank you both. And we'll catch up with you, Paul Reed, in about a month, wherever you might be.
Great.
All right.
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much. That's Paul Reed and Dr. Sarah Owis from Archaeology Southwest, my guests here on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.